morning, everybody. It's now day 14 of the stream, three hearings. The team today, this morning, from Gibson Valley Station and Mulligan's Investments. We have a virtual Gardner Hopkins, who I gather is multitasking in the High Court. Mr. Gardner Hopkins, I think the first item of business is your Mr. Giddens' evidence and the attachments. I see we've also now got a supplementary brief from Mr. Grace. I don't think we need to worry about that since it's what I asked for in my minute on Monday. I haven't read it yet, mind you, so we'll say that. So shall we talk about Mr. Giddens' evidence first? You've read Ms. Scott's response?
Yes, I have. And look, it's entirely understandable the position that Ms. Scott has taken. And certainly as I understand it, there is no opposition to the evidence being introduced and considered by the panel. So if you like, we seem to be over any first hurdle, but she does raise the issue in respect of the technical evidence as to what weight it should be given. And I suppose as part of that, whether letters from a technical author can constitute expert evidence for the purpose of the proceedings. And she did make the point, particularly where the witness or witnesses are not made available for questions. So look, with that in mind, but without wanting to unduly complicate things, as I understand it, the authors of the relevant report and letter are actually available, and they are in the hearing room. And so in order to, I think, remove that, if you like, technical objection to whether or not the information can be considered expert evidence, my submission is that those witnesses can be called before the panel this morning, and each could simply confirm that the letter and report, they are respective authors of them, and that the contents are true and correct to the best of their knowledge, and also confirm that despite not being in evidence format, those matters, the letter and the report meet the requirements of the expert code of conduct, in particular not omitting matters that are relevant and not relying on information that isn't stated in those materials. In my submission, because they are available, that would be appropriate, particularly if any of the panel members had a question arising out of either the letter or the report, in which case that could be put directly to the witness. If there were no questions arising, then perhaps we wouldn't need to go through that exercise at all, and the letter and report could be received and taken into account, but then, of course, with whatever weight the panel ultimately decides to give it. So look, that was really my suggested way forward, just in light of how the circumstances have evolved.
Mr. Gardner Hopkins, it's fair to say that if Ms. Scott had opposed receipt of the technical appendices to Mr. Giddens' evidence, I would probably have agreed with her, given that it is something like, I haven't quite counted, but at least 8 weeks late. council has already opened, the council witnesses have been and gone. I think that Ms. Scott was remarkably generous, suggesting that she didn't object to it being received for what it is. I don't propose to take up your invitation to ask the witnesses questions, because I think that that would compound the prejudice to the council, who has opened its case without this evidence. But I will receive it for what it is worth, as you put it in your covering letter, as it, letters that purport to be technical advice, and we will give it such weight as we think that we should give it in those circumstances.
Yes. And look, I certainly can understand that position. The only response that I would perhaps make is that the letter and the report do deal with two different issues, and I think it is probably fair to acknowledge the report on hazards is clearly in that category of very late, and on an issue that could have been identified earlier. The traffic letter, as I understand it, and look, I haven't personally listened to the audio tapes, I'm afraid, but as I understand it, the issue did arise out of questions from one of the panel members. And it was in light of those questions that the submitter thought it would be appropriate to get some independent advice on that traffic issue. And so perhaps that letter might fall into a slightly different category, and it isn't quite in that same very late camp. But look, I just make that submission. But if the chair is still minded that no questions would be asked of that witness, then of course I accept that, and I wouldn't pursue that any further.
Yes, thank you for that, Mr. Gardner Hopkins. Yes, that is my position. That I think the while the issue did arise out of panel questions, the Skipper's Road would be a strong candidate for the most notorious road in the country. And I think it was reasonably obvious that access to these remote sites what would be an issue and should have been dealt with in evidence. So I'm not minded to open it out any further than it already is. As I say, we have Mr. Bartlett's written report. We will give it such weight as we think it warrants in the circumstances.
Yes, I understand that. And I thank the Chair for your consideration of those issues and accepting the information on the basis stated.
Thank you. You have the floor. I understand a High Court judge is calling, and we know that they don't wait. And we also know that expecting you to do anything other than run and do their bidding is a lost cause. I have also already observed to Mr. Gibbons that it must be several cases of Pinot Noir that you owe him now. But would you like to present your legal submissions?
Yes.
On the basis, as I understand it, that we will cut off at 7:45, wherever you are up to. You will rejoin us at 1:30. If we have any outstanding issues we need to pursue with you, we will do that then. and otherwise we will carry on with your various witnesses, with presumably Mr. Gibbons running the show.
Yes, look, I think de facto he takes over when I need to leave, and I would just observe that I did politely suggest to the High Court that it may be able to start a little later this morning so I could attend the balance of this morning's session, but that was a no-go.
Yes, I would have thought that was... That might have got at least 3 seconds consideration, given the relative status of the hearing bodies. So let's roll on, Mr. Gardner-Hopkins.
Absolutely, and look, these submissions, at least compared to my previous, if were filed in advance. Has the panel had any opportunity to pre-read?
We have indeed.
We
read your submissions last night. Only last night. So I think the Commissioner Dawson is signalling perhaps an overview that is more rather than less. I myself, I think I'm on top of them, but as I say, I think you need to tell us, I don't want you to read them, but I think you need to pull more of the eyes out of them than you would otherwise do.
Yes, well, look, perhaps then I can start at paragraph 10, which is just the part of the submissions dealing with jurisdiction. We've dealt with the preliminary matter on the new information. And, look, I go into a little bit of detail, but the nub of my submission is the relief that is currently sought is within the scope of the submissions, and the panel does have jurisdiction to entertain the relief. And in some respects, through the production of the evidence and consideration of the counsel's evidence in replying, the number of amendments sought to the RVZ provisions has been whittled down compared to what was originally on the table. And so I do think there is now some precision around the relief sought, and we've tried to make that very clear in the attachment to my submission. And as the panel may have seen, that attachment consolidates the relief being sought for these two submitters. So it's all in one place. And look, to some extent, I accept that some of that relief is relying on a general statement in the submissions about appropriate amendments to address matters raised or additional and consequential relief. But my submission is that that is not an uncommon basis for jurisdiction. That some latitude can also be given in the context of this process if the relief is related to an issue raised in the submission. That really is my submission on the jurisdiction point. And look, through the chair, is it convenient to take questions on the way through, or to try and wrap things up at the end?
I suppose my reaction is that it's one thing to base fill in the odd gap using a consequential catch-all, but you seem to have, with the exception of the height provision, which is clearly the subject of specific relief sought, you seem to have built rather a lot of some very general catch-alls. I wondered if you could give me any authority that would support the idea that those sort of general provisions provide jurisdictional support for a range of planning provisions that are made up on the fly.
Yes, well, the authority that comes to mind, I think, is the Forest and Bird case, where the High Court in that case did say that these things shouldn't be approached in terms of a legal nicety, indicating that some latitude should be given. But look, I haven't included that in my written synopsis, and perhaps because I am back this afternoon, I can give the panel a specific reference either to that case or any others. I should have the ability to dig that out.
Understood. Let's leave it on that basis that you'll return to the fray this afternoon. The other point I question I had really arose out of your paragraph 11, where you're distinguishing a plan review from plan changes. I wondered whether, in terms of scope and jurisdiction, it was the inverse, that plan changes require a more technical approach arising out of motor machinists and Clearwater and the cases that have followed it, than a complete plan review where Justice Fotter's Albany decision says basically it's open slather.
Yes, and my response to that is that the waters have perhaps been muddied somewhat here, because this is in effect a plan review, but pursued through a series of plan changes and variations. And I think that has, on a range of matters, just caused some difficulties and provides a particular set of circumstances that, in my submission, would permit perhaps a more lenient eye to be taken on whether or not relief is squarely within scope or is specifically identified in an originating submission.
That you're certainly, Judge Jackson's been voluble on that subject.
Yes.
I'll need to ponder that. But unless anyone else has any questions about jurisdiction.
I suppose when I read the submissions last night, and not the legal submissions, your actual submissions, and they were, apart from the amendment requested relating to height in Gibson Valley, they were silent, really, on any issues or matters of difficulty with the RV zone. I mean, if anything, they were full of praise for the RV zone as being entirely suitable for these two sites. Now, I guess there's a difference between making subsequent amendments when matters are raised relating to slight difficulties with the site and maybe constraining them in relation to, I don't know, building colours or specific locations within the site where certain things can happen. But the attachment to your evidence and to the planner's evidence expand that scope to all sorts of new activities, residential activity, greater building coverage, changes in activity status, taking away more non-notification provisions, a structure plan that's now to mean that subdivision is a controlled activity, much wider aspects than were in the notified plan or could possibly be in my initial assessment, were not raised as matters or issues in the original submissions. So any authority that you come back with needs to address not the narrowing and dealing with issues, but the expanding of those of the provisions of the zone.
Yes, understood. And I'll bear that in mind when I look at the authorities.
So, Nick, on that basis, would you care to carry on?
Yes, thank you. So, look, to the zoning, and the submission is there is little or no fundamental opposition on an evidential basis to refuse the RVZ zoning requests. Now, I do make some differentiation, notwithstanding that submission, to the two different sites. I do think the evidential basis and any evidential matters that might be problematic is much lesser in respect of the Gibson Valley site. There's an issue as to whether or not the boundary of the site at Gibson should be reduced to remove the western or some of the western part of the site, and so to have the boundary run along the natural ridge line. For Gibson Valley Station, that is not an issue, and it sees some logic with following that particular geographic feature. And one reason that that's not an issue for it is that the site, the area that's proposed to be removed doesn't contain any of the low sensitivity areas that are suggested as appropriate for development sites. And it can see the logic in keeping the wider boundary of these RVZ sites reasonably tight, if that's an appropriate way to express that. So, look, that particular change isn't opposed, and on that basis, the submission is there is no impediment for this panel to approve that rezoning. And look, depending on where we get to with jurisdiction, there may or may not be some additional amendments to be made to the RVZ provisions, either as they apply to that particular RVZ location, or perhaps more generally. But as I say, that final level of detail may depend on the jurisdictional question. In respect of the Skipper's site, again, the reporting planner has suggested a reduction in the boundary, and that's just repeated at my paragraph 17. And it raises a few issues for Maligan's Investments. It's not fundamentally opposed, as I've said at the start of my paragraph 18, but the preference is for the original extent of the zoning to remain. And that's linked to a couple of key reasons. One depends on where the panel gets to with the 10-metre setback in terms of whether it should apply to that location, and therefore whether there is a further effective reduction in the area that can be used for intended RVZ activities. But also the slightly odd dynamic between the existing underlying zoning, which would allow for development in the area to be excluded as a discretionary activity, whereas if the RVZ zoning is applied, then buildings and the like become non-complying because that area is not part of the low sensitivity areas identified for potential development.
Can I query that, Governor Hopkins? I think that that might turn on whether that land is classified as moderate high or high. If it were classified as high sensitivity, you'd be right. If it were classified as moderate high, as Mr. Milne suggests, they would both be discretionary.
Yes, I would accept that. Yes. So the consequences and the basis of my non-complying distinction would depend on the final finding as to moderate to high or high. I accept that. And so also on skippers, and this is why I am differentiating slightly between the two in terms of fundamental impediments. The impediment identified in the evidence was the natural hazards issue. And my submission there is that there is now some information before the panel in terms of the report that in my submission, even if not subject to the rigors of questioning, provides an evidential basis for the panel to be satisfied that natural hazards are not an impediment to the future development of the site, or are not at such a level that they could not be addressed through the consideration of future resource consents. And the panel would have seen one of the additions that the two submitters are happy to have included as matters for restricted discretion relates to hazards, natural hazards. And so in my submission, there is enough information or evidence before the panel to not reject the zoning on that basis, but with, if you like, some safety net that for most consents that would trigger a RDA status, natural hazards would be part of the matters that could be considered by the council, and that consent could conceivably be declined on that basis, or conditions imposed to ensure safe development.
Mr. Gardner-Hopkins, on the 10-metre setback issue I'll discuss with Mr. Milne, but it occurs to me that there might be a case to have a 10-metre setback on the underside of the site, but not the top side. So
yes.
So that it's set back from the terrace edge, I'm just floating a concept. Now, if the evidence were to support that, I appreciate that you're not sitting next to your client, but I'll float that as a possibility. Where do you think you'd be sitting then?
Yes, look, I think generally the evidence will dictate really both what the panel may be able to conclude, but what the submitter can reasonably put forward as their relief sought. So, look, I will defer on that to see what Mr. Milne says, and then we may have to take it from there.
Okay, understood. Any other questions on that section? Governor Hopkins here, submissions? Please roll on.
Thank you. So, look, turning to some of the specific amendments, and, look, the first heading deals with the structure plans. And for both of the proposed RVZ zones a structure plan approach is intended. And as I understand it, for the original RVZ zones as notified, they so not these new ones, but for the ones that were notified, they did include structure plans. And so it did seem, if you like, an accepted or acceptable approach or an appropriate approach. And the submitters really sought to build on that for the zones that they are proposing to provide some greater certainty, both for their own, if you like, development aspirations, but also to assist in the assessment of effects so that the likely areas for development are clearly identified through the structure plan.
Mr. Gardner-Hopkins, before you roll on, I think Commissioner Dawson has an issue with
As I read the notified, or even this Section 42A version of the RV zone, there were no structure plans, certainly not in the notified ones. There were areas of landscape sensitivity shown on the planning maps, but they didn't come, they weren't a structure plan, they just were the basis for some differentiation of rules within the zone. And that subdivision within the rural visitor zone, all subdivision, was to be this full discretionary activity in the notified provisions. And that's continued over into the 42A second rebuttal version. So
yes,
it's quite a significant change to bring in the structure plans and to then bring in the what you call an unintended consequence, but it is a consequence anyway of bringing in a structure plan, that the subdivision status might revert to controlled activity.
If I may comment.
Look, I'm certainly very happy to be corrected as to the factual position as to what was notified, and it may be that one of the planners in the submitter group can assist with that. But I would accept if that wasn't an approach that was originally taken with the notified RVZ zones, then, if you like, that would be a question mark as to the use of a structure plan as a mechanism for these two additional zones. What I would say is that the structure plan, one of the issues is what more does a structure plan add if the district plan maps are to identify the different areas of landscape sensitivity? And certainly I accept, I think the structure plans would need to add something more. And in my submission, each of these structure plans proposed does do that. And I think the respective planners, if not Mr. Milne, may be able to speak to any differences in the developable areas identified in the structure plans and the low sensitivity or low to moderate sensitivity areas that might be shown on the planning maps.
One thing that the reporting officer raises is what does a structure, why do we need a structure plan? Because, I mean, there are all sorts of ways of including rules. A structure plan isn't the only way. Just a little map that says these are the developable areas within the zone is a perfectly legitimate way of having additional controls, such as Mr. Milne's suggesting. So there is quite a continuum between the council's proposed position of just having landscape areas on the planning maps to a structure plan, which brings with it all the other matters that structure plans bring with it in the district plan as it is.
Yes, and I accept that. And the submission really is that the submitters here were trying to obtain some greater certainty, as I say, both for their own development aspirations, but also to enable a clear assessment of effects against the developable areas and any other features that are identified on the structure plan, such as access, as I understand it.
On the score of structure plans, Mr. Gardner Hopkins, I picked up on your statement at 20 sub B, really the last sentence of B. It's incorrect to say that conditions can't reduce the number of lots. I had in the context of the subdivision chapter of this plan, I had a very lengthy discussion with Ms. Baker-Galloway about the scope of conditions, and she was seeking controlled activity status precisely so that the council did not have jurisdiction over the number and size of lots. So when you say that's incorrect, can you give me some authority for that proposition?
Look, it's probably something else I need to come back to you on. I have some anecdotal experience where a consent authority has pushed back on lot numbers through a controlled activity consent. I think probably ultimately that's been agreed rather than imposed. But it is an issue that arises at least not infrequently as to what the bounds are for controlled activity around matters like lot size, location, and number. And my submission is it becomes a matter of sort of fact in the circumstance as to whether or not conditions that might reduce or change those matters turn the proposal into something different or effectively are tantamount to declining the proposal. Because my read of the authorities are that those are the touchstones for what is permissible in a controlled activity process. The conditions obviously can be imposed, but they can't change the fundamental nature of the proposal, and they can't effectively decline it. And within those jurisdictional bounds, my submission is that changes to the number and layout are permissible in a controlled activity process.
The submission Ms. Baker-Galloway was made to me was that reducing the number was a fundamental change to what was being applied for in a subdivision context. Could it be a issue of scale and degree? Knocking off the odd unit here and there is arguably the subject of conditions, but halving them is not.
Yes, that would be my submission. And in terms of location, I think, you know, conditions can move lots around, again, within reason. If there is some basis for avoiding, look, whether it's a hazard, a landscape issue, some other natural feature, then I think it would be quite extraordinary to suggest that no movement of the boundaries of a subdivision would be permissible. And so I do think it is a matter of degree and assessment in the circumstances of when a change through a condition goes too far.
finished with that section of your submission, Gareth Hopkins, please roll on. I'm looking at the clock, which says 9:41.
Yes, and look, and I think we're starting to get to some of the more, if you like, specific rules.
Do you want us to talk to your planners about those?
Yes, well look, these are the subjects to evidence. Look, I am conscious of time. I'm very close to the High Court building, so probably I would like to address the panel on this issue of the extent of built form and this 500 square metre trigger, which moves buildings from being controlled through to non-complying. And is not non-complying, sorry, through to restricted discretionary. And I suppose this is something that has evolved through the process. As I understand it, the original standard or trigger was simply on individual buildings. And so within the RVZ, all buildings within the low landscape sensitivity areas were controlled, unless individually a building had a greater GFA ground floor of 500 squares. That's then morphed into 500 squares ground GFA across the entire site. And look, perhaps some of the developer clients can talk to this, but as I understand it, from a practical perspective, if a lodge proposal with some associated accommodation units were to be developed, then it would always exceed the 500 square metre threshold. And so this threshold, if you like, de facto makes development or buildings restricted discretionary. Now, the submitters that I'm acting for don't actually have an issue with that. They accept that could be or is on the present formulation the likely outcome because they are happy with the matters reserved for discretion, and they are of the view that any sensible proposal is likely to obtain consent when assessed against the relevant objectives and policies informing the matters reserved for discretion. So they don't see it as particularly problematic, other than it's a very low threshold and will almost always be crossed. So the one suggestion was, well, why not front up to it and just rather than have controlled status, have RDA for all buildings, because that's the practical result given the nature of the zone and development that is anticipated. Some thought was given to whether or not a higher threshold might be appropriate, but that was considered likely to be zone or site specific, and also potentially at the plan change or plan development stage, too fine-grained a detail to properly assess whether a threshold should be 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, or 5,000, or whatever the number is. And so that's really the submission and the issues around that particular standard.
Mr. Gardner Hopkins, probably a parting shot for you to think about. You've drawn the link between your clients being, content is probably an overstatement, but content with 500 with the link to non-notification. I should probably put to you that least in my mind, an issue about with non-notification, where the issues are not solely related to landscape. You've drawn the point was, well, if it's low sensitivity, then it's legitimate to be non-notified. We have at least, well, we've got 14 applications for new RV zones, and at least one that we've already heard has some significant traffic issues that directly affect the neighbours. And so that, so my parting shot as you run into the High Court, you might think about is whether we can assume that non-notification is only a landscape issue and therefore is solved by the low sensitivity classification.
Yes. Look, I think it has to extend beyond landscape, particularly if you look at the, if you like, possibly expanding matters reserved for discretion. Certainly, my clients have indicated acceptance of density of development and traffic effects. Now, partly that's because they think it's appropriate to consider traffic, but also it removes some uncertainty because density of development could be taken as including traffic effects. Because, of course, you know, the more intense or the greater the development, then the greater traffic generation is likely to occur. So also for my clients, though, in terms of their zones, they make, or I make the submission that neighbours have not sought to join the proceedings in opposition. NZTA has not either, and the non-notification rule is appropriate in those circumstances. But look, I am conscious of time. I'm going to have to run across the road. So unless there's anything very quick, I will leave you in the capable hands of Mr. Giddens to just indicate which witnesses are next.
Yes, you had better run. It wouldn't be good if you were late over the road, Mr. Gardner-Hopkins.
Correct. My gown is already in there. I have to get there and put my gown on before the judge arrives. So thank you very much. I appreciate the panel's accommodation of my competing considerations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How are we going to do this? Which submitter are we going to start with?
Gibson Valley Station will be first off. And just on the matter of scope there raised by Mr. Gardner-Hopkins, if there are legal matters being raised there, which obviously you've been discussing with him, I'll likely defer those matters to Mr. Gardner-Hopkins
rather than getting into
that debate myself.
One of the crosses he has to bear is that is to get a list over lunch, I suspect.
I mean, he prepared the submissions too, didn't he? Not
yes,
you.
Correct.
Not
all correct.
Right. Mr. Farrell.
Correct.
Beard on his own head then.
So in terms of the state of play for Gibson Valley Station, it'd be Mr. Greg Hunt, who is the applicant or representative of the applicant up first, followed by Mr. Milne Landscape, Mr. Carr Traffic, and myself planning to round things out.
Okay, so we'll start with GBS. Mr. Hunt.
Thank you. I assume you want me to read this?
No, you assume incorrectly.
Okay.
Yeah,
oh,
you've got a
summary.
Much shorter than your evidence,
there.
Mr. Hunt.
Have you given us a summary?
Yeah.
Somewhere. Yes, I do want you to read the summary thing. I thought you meant your evidence.
No. Now, I know I drive K consultants crazy because I'll probably talk more bluntly from a client's perspective in regard to matters as opposed to what may be correct. And just with that as a premise, I will start. My name is Greg Hunt, and I am the CEO and one of the two directors of Gibson Valley Station. I have provided evidence in support of our rezoning submission dated 29 May 2020. My background and experience are detailed in that document. Gibson Valley is in the unique position of having an established brand that is well known in the New Zealand tourism and hospitality market. It is perceived as a quality brand with a quality product providing, too many qualities, experience for those visiting our facilities. We have worked very hard to create this perception, and it is one that we bring to the development of the resort zone should the commissioners agree with its inclusion in the district plan. It is also important that any proposal in the rural visitor zone is one that is financially viable and will be seen as an asset to the local community. For the past 16 years, we, that is myself and the Gibson Valley team, have been working towards developing Gibson Valley as a destination, not only for wine and food, but for experiences and accommodation. We completed the lodge and spa adjacent to the winery at the end of last year and had the Resort Valley, the Gibson Valley Resort Zone on the flats of the station land approved at the end of last year. I foresee that development in the rural visitor zone will stand separately from either of these developments and have its own unique characteristics, attributes. We have been actively engaging with the New Zealand Transport Agency since 2008 regarding our various access points for the station, including the establishment of underpasses and very recently the possibility of a roundabout. The agency is very supportive of the approach that we take to development, and I believe this is testament to the fact that they did not oppose our zoning requests for the resort or the rural visitor zone. You have now visited the site, and I am sure recognise that it has a sense of serenity and separation from the activities of Gibson closer to the state highway. I believe those staying in our lodge and spa may stay in the retreat lodge for a different experience. In addition, I would foresee it will be available for independent travellers, tourists, business retreats, and so on. To create an image in your mind of the style of the lodge, imagine Minaret Lodge. It is this sense of being separated from the day-to-day hustle and bustle and being able to relax that will be the point of difference to other accommodation options. As I outlined in my evidence, the fact that we have an existing management team in place to develop and run this facility also gives certainty to the wider and local community that we can create an amenity that will be an asset not only to ourselves but the outside community as well. When considering proposals like this, I believe it is important to see how realistic the applicant is and what is their experience in creating something that is appropriate and will be financially successful. In my evidence, I outlined the reason for asking for 180 days for a residential stay in the accommodation units. It is important that we retain as high of an occupancy rate as we can throughout the year. COVID-19 has taught us, and I'm meaning Gibson Valley, that events can occur. We do not have visitors, but owners may utilise the facilities for a longer period during these events. In addition, the owners or their friends and family may come and stay for a month or longer during specific seasons. The more certainty we have in regard to our overall occupancy means the more certainty we have in retaining our staff and the financial viability of the development. The provision for workers' accommodation is also essential to our business, not only for providing essential accommodation, but helping us retain and secure key staff in long-term positions. I'm happy to discuss any matters with you.
Thank you, Mr. Hunt. I have two areas of inquiry, both a little tangential. First of all, the council team has given us a copy of the materials related to your resort zone, including not just the plan provisions, but also the memoranda that went to the court back and that discusses the background to it. Although not, this is actually for the purposes of our consideration of another proposal that we're going to be considering. But since you're here, I'll take the opportunity to ask you the question. I understand that part of your proposal, and you already got a resource consent for a golf course between the state highway and the river.
Yes.
And is that still part of the resort plan? Because the resort zoning is non-specific as to how you would use that area.
Sure. I'll take a not too long-winded approach to that answer. We got our original resource consent back in 2008. GFC hit. Was not exactly the right time to open a resort. Also back in 2008, Michael Hill's course hadn't been built, Jack's Point hadn't been built, and our understand, Greg Turner was our consultant for golf, that a destination needs it, if they can, five golf courses to appeal to golf enthusiasts when they're coming to an area, perception being they can play five, you know, one course a day when they're here, if they're staying for a week, for example. We looked at a golf course, and I am aware other applicants are putting golf courses forward. Ours was for a totally different reason as to why I believe they've put them forward. We saw golf as a resort activity. We were visitor and are visitor accommodation primarily in this resort. And as time has gone by, cycling has become fairly significant in New Zealand, thanks to John Key and what he started. We saw Gibston sitting very nicely between the existing trails in the Central Otago area and what has now been developed in Queenstown, what is being proposed through the Kawera Gorge and also over to Wanaka. So we saw cycling starting to take the position of golf. Also, we have developed the concerts, so entertainment is part of our business now. And we've also recognised wine and food. People, when they travel now, want experiences. They don't want to potentially just stay somewhere and lie on a beach or, you know, sit and do nothing. They want to actually do something. So part of our other application is also education. We're looking at putting in what I call the Glenlee campus, culinary oenology schools, because people, as I say, they want to do these things. So I said it would be a long-winded. Golf I'm still considering, but not as an 18-hole course. I'm looking at doing a 9-hole short course, because again, the old concept of 18 holes, I don't believe fits with our model, and it takes a lot of land up. Whereas the short course, if somebody's staying for 2 to 3 days, which is our ideal visitor, you know, it's another reason they will stay with us, and it's only an afternoon, you know, 2-3 hours, and you're done. Also, the style of golf course, you know, and Greg Turner hates it, but I say if you imagine like the terrace golf course, it's something that browns in the winter, greens in the summer. We leave all of our landscape attributes that we have as part of the golf course, if we do build one. So the answer to your question is probably in regard to the resort zone, having a golf course.
It doesn't require it to be built for other things to follow, for example.
It doesn't require it at all. Cycling has taken over, and underlying, you know, all of our vineyards are we're heading towards being organic. So underlying our whole resort is the concept of organic sustainability and experiences. And so golf is a potential for that.
If there's any questions in relation to the planning element of the resort, I'm happy to answer those.
Like I said, I just wanted to understand, because it wasn't specifically mentioned, whether you'd retreated from the original concept. And the answer, I think, is yes.
We have. The short answer, yes.
And yep. I also wanted to talk to you about the 180 days.
I thought you would.
My understanding is that or something similar to it was the basis on which Millbrook commenced, with only units being put in a pool but available for some period of time for the owners to use.
I was involved in Millbrook, as you would have
yes,
read, through 93.
Hence my question.
Yeah, no, it wasn't back then. I think, and I may be corrected, but the 180, I think, is a far more recent outcome with Millbrook. If I can, the 180 days, you know, you guys have seen, I've been involved in quite a lot of projects, and I was involved with yourselves for a while on one. I always believe that you shouldn't be putting anything, I don't care about the rules, to put it bluntly. I would rather do a project that is correct, and I would rather fight the rules and do something that I know is a good outcome that the wider community will take up, that we know will be financially successful. And the reason for the 180 is not to try and sneak in residential. The fact is that think of perception. When people go to a hotel, they see a swimming pool. Are they ever going to use that swimming pool? No, but it has one. And so it adds to the appeal. For us with our buyers, because this is a large project and we don't want to take all of the debt on ourselves. Certain aspects we will, but other aspects we would like to have people involved, freehold purchasers. And those purchasers are going to look at it and go, well, why should I buy a unit here? And part of that is the perception. And I believe, like Millbrook, when I was there anyway, the bulk of the owners were from Auckland. They weren't from overseas. But they look at it and go, oh, yeah, I could go there for a month in the winter. I might go there for a month in the summer as well. You know, maybe we'll go other times. So it's just to make it more financially viable is the reason for the 180 days. And I had this discussion with Craig Barr, when we were doing it. And, you know, and so he understood that. So, and with that perception, and I outlined in my evidence, the fact is it's still visitor accommodation. We are setting up a management company to run and manage these units. You know, the concept of concierge, where if the owner comes and stays, the unit's ready for them and they stay, just the same as if you're a visitor. But we want, and we believe, once we get through this COVID and borders open up again, we're going to have a very unique offering. And I've looked at a lot of areas throughout the world, in the world, where you can come and stay and experience the things in a setting that most places don't offer, and we believe we will run successfully. But that visitor accommodation units that may be freehold owned, they are visitor accommodation. If an owner wants to stay in it, just like they did at Millbrook when I was there, they have to put their name forward and apply for a period of time. You know, they don't have it as of right over a visitor. But in saying that, if we don't have a unit available if the visitors don't want to use it, it is better to have the owner or their friends staying there and spending money and making the resort more active than having it sitting there empty. So that's the reason why. And 180, you know, it's just a perception of getting the appeal for these units.
Because my question was why, I mean, 90 is within the definition.
I understand, yeah.
So that's, I mean, when all your examples, you say, well, a month here and maybe a month later and even up to 3 months in one part of the year and 3 months in another part of the year, that would all come within the current definition.
Understand.
So why 6 months?
Just because it's that perception. if you're an owner and the perception is 3 months is not a long time perceived by an owner, and I'm saying this from our experience and what we've found out when we've been looking at the model for the resort. You know, we spend a lot of I spend, you know, 5 years developing this and doing a lot of research and asking the real estate industries, asking the accommodation, and we just believe, rightly or wrongly, you know, and I can accept, and I realise, you know, that you would ask about the 89 days, that we want, I also don't want, and this is a fault of Millbrook, I don't want this development to, hell, I won't be around, I don't want it to take 20 years to build. I want to be able to get the capital investment and so that we can put all of the infrastructure, the roading, the landscaping in place before we actually go with the buildings, you know, because it has greater appeal. To do that, I need to sell these units. And if I look at it from an effect space, whether it's an owner, and I realise this is just my argument, an owner or a visitor staying in there, the effects are no different. The true effect is it gives me a better opportunity to sell these units.
Okay. I understand. That's all I have.
I was going to ask about the 180 days. I'd like to pick that up with the legal and the planning argument.
I don't think you have questions or something more.
You mentioned workers' accommodation.
Yeah.
So the provisions for the RV zone allow for on-site accommodation for both the visitor accommodation and even commercial recreation. So if you've got an activity base there. So is that what you're meaning? Or are you meaning other workers, some from further afield?
Yeah, if you've had a look at our resort zone, you'll note we have an area called AA8, and I have approval for 90 bedrooms it's classified as residential because there is
no correct zoning. Yeah.
So, but that is for staff accommodation. And
staff
within
at the resort. Staff
within
the
resort,
resort.
Yeah, I have a specific area within it. Because one thing we know, the town is coming out towards us, but we have learned that when our staff are coming, if we can offer them short-term accommodation, there's two areas. It's not the middle area.
Yeah, so I'm actually really interested in the RV zone. So what accommodation would you be envisaging, or because you mentioned workers' accommodation in the RV zone, up the hill. So what accommodation for workers are you envisaging there?
Yeah, I can actually show you, within those numbers, the number two would be where I'd be looking at the visitor
workers' accommodation.
I hate that term,
staff
accommodation.
Staff accommodation, yeah. But it would be for staff working within the RV zone. Or would you have resort staff up there as well?
I don't know, to be quite honest. It could be both, because the fact is we're going to use the same management team to run both, so the chances are.
Yeah.
But it's an area that I've identified that is not suitable for, because it's separated, for the visitor, but it would be suitable for staff.
Right. So my final other question is, why aren't you looking at this as an extension of the resort zone?
Ah, I knew that one too. I went over with James the three questions, and I can
because
understand
because you've just
why.
Said you're going to be sharing workers and management,
exactly.
And you've got flexibility.
It's a fairly straightforward answer, and it's a business answer in a sense, in that we got our consent back in 2007, let's say, for that area. So when I did the resort zone, I wanted to apply it to that same area, it made sense so that the council could understand the difference between the two areas.
We've heard a lot of baseline arguments.
Yeah. Hey, mine is not any argument to try and get it through the back door. Mine was just a very practical consideration. Because the area's changed. But in saying that, also I knew that area up there was in an ONL, and I didn't want to complicate our resort zone at that point. And the rural visitor zone, I wasn't aware of the opportunity, and that came along, as far as I was aware, after the resort zone was approved. Because Phil and I, that's my business partner, we'd always looked at that area up there as that retreat lodge experience, because it is a beautiful block of land. But, and yes, it will be. I see our guests that stay in the resort. They may book a night up there for that different experience. But that's the main reason. I didn't want to complicate
like
the resort zone.
The planning system just led it that way. Sort of.
Correct.
Thing.
Yeah.
That's all.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, Mr. Hunt. I don't doubt for one second Greg Turner being upset when you mentioned Taras as a golf course to it upsets. It was always a backdoor membership to Wanaka was getting spending $50 on Taras. But the one question I have is can you give me some surety, or what is the surety in the long term? Millbrook started out as a resort, as the temporary accommodation. I'd value your experience because you were there at the start, and I'd like your opinion of, does it still qualify as a resort today?
We don't have any media in here, do we?
You are captured for posterity.
That's okay.
People can listen to you online later.
My view is the new areas of development, I think they're far too high density, to put it bluntly, and it is more residential in scale, what they're doing. What we're proposing, and I was very happy to work with the council, was that 70-30 split VA to true residential. That's not our intent at all. And I think my short answer was what I gave you there in regard to where Millbrook has gone after I left.
And what, with the best will in the world, because this is creating something which is your vision, which it is what it is, but this will be lasting for a long time, and it will be setting a precedent and creating for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So your surety in terms of what would you want, a quality product, the community wants a quality product. Where do you see the surety that it won't end up being another Melbourne?
We've had this discussion before when I've put other things forward. I think you guys can look at my track record. You know, every development that I've done, I can take pride in, and I think the community, especially in Wanaka, have taken ownership of all of those. And we didn't develop the resort back in 2006, for primarily financial reasons, but also we kind of knew it wasn't time yet, and that's why I got a 15-year life on it for the consent. And also, as time has gone by, we've developed the model to a point now where we are comfortable and we're ready, and we know this is the right model for us as a company. But it's also the right outcome. It's where Gibson is going. You know, you look at overseas areas like Napa is an obvious one, and really there isn't any others in the world that are truly winery tourism destinations. Gibson is not grape growing. It truly isn't. It's only 1 in 4 years you get a very good harvest. What it is a great destination for experiences. And I know we've gone into the resort, but the rural visitor zone for us is another experience that will stand alone, but it also is a great addition to what we're looking at putting together there.
And it's interesting to say that it's not grape growing. Mr. Dicey might have a slightly different argument.
Because I had this vision of Mr. Dicey in my mind.
I'm sure he's broken my left ear.
That was why I was curious to see what he would come up with for the upper plateau. And he actually supports the fact that Gibson Valley on that upper plateau is marginal at very, very best. And in fact, I don't actually want grapes up there because I hate having those pylons, but I try and ignore them. But that experience up there, just a tiny little short anecdote. when Phil and I first looked at the property, we went up there with Phil's wife, Donna, who's passed, and she's from the Bronx and very much a city woman. And we went up on that upper plateau and we went right down the end, and she looked down into Camp Creek and a beautiful little waterfall. And she goes, wow, how did they build that? That was her perception coming from built-in experiences. That experience up there is something we really, I want to put the resort, and that's why I use Minaret, put the resort lodge, some independent units up there, and then leave the grassland around it. You know, it's just a unique experience up there.
And just with Minaret, do you envisage quite a lot of helicopter movements in there?
Well, we have a helipad approved on the resort. I've never envisioned, and I know Brett had put something in there, I think, for it. We'd never envisioned the helicopters landing up there, but helicopters in Gibson are not abnormal because they're used for frost fighting.
Yes.
So it's not. I don't think anyone would have any problem with it.
And it's interesting, just on the staff accommodation, because I have a slightly different view about staff accommodation, but it did, if you look at the zoning and the impact zones, the 1, 2, 3, 4, two always struck me as being a little odd.
Yeah.
Because it's proximity to other houses, it's proximity to the road.
Yep.
And so that was the bottom line, is looking at, and do you find that it's becoming a necessity to?
Well, the two areas for staff accommodation that are needed from our experience, one is that short term, people moving into town until they establish. So we'll provide that more in 2, 3, 4 block units. The other one is our middle management and senior management who can't afford to buy a damn house. And I've worked with the Community Housing Trust, on a couple of different developments. What I'm proposing, and I'd like to actually look at in that area, even though Brett said I shouldn't say it, is the idea that we retain ownership of the land and we will build units with our senior staff where they can put in a capital investment, and as long as they're working with us, every year that they're living in that house, I'll pick a figure, they get a $10,000 capital gain value on it. So if they're working with us for 5 years, they get $50,000. They then sell the unit back to us, their initial cost, plus they get the capital gain. And then they can go out into the marketplace with a deposit somewhere else. That property stays with us, so then another part of our team will have a structure where they can buy that off us and live in there the same way. I saw that potentially in that area as opposed to a block of units. You know, I could see two or three houses like that because it's houses that are in that area and behind it. That's what I was sort of thinking of.
There we go.
And just to clarify Mr. Hunt's comment about me advising not to say, there was just contextually that regime would be sitting outside of planning provisions,
yeah,
in terms
exactly
of how that works.
But might not if they all work in the rural visitor zone.
Mm.
Correct.
Well, it's enabled already,
yeah,
through that rural visitor,
yeah,
visitor accommodation definition.
There's a consenting pathway if you wish to
correct
follow it.
Mm. Correct.
All right. Who's next?
Mr. Milne.
Yes.
Thank you.
So are you just going to do Gibson first, or are you going to do them both?
Gibson first.
I thought Gibson first, just on the basis of
all
the
today. So we'll keep the, we'll do all Gibson, then all.
I thought that'd be a bit cleaner.
All skippers.
Just have a summary statement of my evidence being certified at the moment.
Thank you.
Freddie Douglas Milne and my qualifications and experiences set out in my evidence achieved. This summary of evidence sets out key points in my previous evidence. I've also read the rebuttal evidence of Mr. Matthew Johns on behalf of Queensland Lakes District Council, and I respond to his comments in this summary. Gibson Valley Station is seeking rezoning of an area of land to rural visitor zone under the PDP. Site currently is split zone over Gibson Character Zone and Rural Zone with an overlay of outstanding natural landscape. The proposed zone is located south of the highway and encompasses a site of approximately 109 hectares, which is bound to the north by the power lines which traverse the Gibson Valley Station property through the GCZ land. The site has a rural character and a moderate to high natural character. Landscape and amenity values are largely associated with the broad-scale landforms which form a backdrop to Gibson Valley. The site has a sense of remoteness due to the elevated and contained topography. The visual influence of the site is limited due to the complex folded landform and elevated setback from the highway corridor. An assessment of the site's landscape sensitivity has been undertaken, incorporating analysis of the site's character and values. The landscape sensitivity analysis has informed the proposed structure plan, which the proposed developable areas are located in areas of lower landscape sensitivity. These are considered to be appropriate locations for potential future development within the RVZ according to the policies and rules of the Section 42A report recommended Chapter 46, subject to those amendments suggested by Mr. Gibbons. The proposed primary development areas exhibit factors including, but not limited to, favourable topography, ease of access, reasonable sunlight access, quality views, and presence of existing modifications. As indicated on the structure plan, not all areas of lower sensitivity are included within one of the primary developable areas. This is not to say that these areas are unsuitable in any way. They have been left out because it is preferred that primary development areas are contiguous and of an appropriate size and shape to allow for a clustered approach to development. Since lodgement on 28 May 2020, no changes have been made to the proposed structure plan. Additional provisions have been put forward for the zone and include a 7-metre building height limit within primary developable area 1 and 3, a rural standard for roading and infrastructure, and inclusion of walkative building materials and colours standard with the allowances for sympathetic design, cladding materials and colours to enhance the landscape character of the zone. I consider these provisions to be appropriate from a landscape perspective. In the context of the assessment of landscape effects, I consider the proposed rezoning to be appropriate as the structure plan and proposed primary developable areas have been informed by the landscape sensitivity analysis in order to select suitable areas for the application of the RVZ and exclude areas of moderate to high or high landscape sensitivity. Landscape effects on a whole are considered to be low as the changes are sensitive to the character and values of the surrounding landscape, and the proposed primary developable areas are generally contained within the application site. As a result, I consider the values of the surrounding rural zone O&L and character of the GCZ will be maintained. In the context of the assessment of visual amenity effects, I find that overall adverse effects in visual amenity arising from the proposed zone will be low in the context of the receiving environment. This is attributed to the limited visibility of the proposed zone and the considered approach outlined by the proposed structure plan, which seeks to locate the proposed primary developable areas in areas of low visual influence. Therefore, it is considered that the effects of development resulting from the proposed zoning change will not be at odds with existing patterns of development in the wider landscape and will represent a change that is acceptable in the context of views on Gibson Valley and the surrounding landscape. Just quickly address the landscape matters raised by Mr. Jones. In his rebuttal evidence, Mr. Jones refers to the proposed RVZ and provisions and indicates that the primary reasons for his initial opposition have been effectively addressed from a landscape perspective, and that he has changed the assessment conclusion reached in his and chief. And now there's a proposed rezoning relief sought for the site and supports the changes and provisions regarding building height, roading infrastructure, and building materials. I set out in paragraphs 11 to 14 some comments on statutory framework. I'm thinking I probably don't need to just traverse that. And in conclusion, the proposed rural visitor zone provides for a holistic approach to development within the application site, while providing for certainty of protection for the landscape values of the receiving environment. Therefore, I consider that the proposed RVZ zone is an appropriate fit for the site in terms of landscape and visual matters. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Milne, and thank you for your high quality visuals that have made our understanding of the site much easier.
Thank you.
I have two requests rather than questions for you. During our site visit, we went up Crown Range Road and stood on the viewpoint that you've taken a photo of your viewpoint, and we were trying to figure out where the development areas were in that viewpoint. And we think we figured them out, but that's always dangerous for a panel effectively trying to superimpose different material. Can you please take your viewpoint photo and give us, not now, obviously, I don't want you to describe where it is because we'll probably get that wrong too, but give us a, in effect, like a white dot round the suggested viewpoints.
Yes, for sure.
And while I'm asking for you complete information, for additional information, and Mr. Hunt will probably flinch, so we'll change the subject matter. I understand that you will not be able to attend the hearing, and we'll be zooming in on the 12th of August for Cadrona Cattle Company.
Yes, that's right.
Before you zoom in, given that you are physically present at the moment, we are interested in the view as you come from the Cromwell side, you come along the straight with the Nevis on the other side of the valley, you come round the corner, and the site that you're, the southern site that you're discussing in your evidence, is in front of you.
Yes.
You told us in your evidence for that company that your ability to provide a visualisation was COVID constrained. I understand that. But that is what I would like, please, if you could, while you're here, go out and prepare a visualisation, not so much of what you can see, because, again, we were trying to envisage where are the boundaries of the two suggested development areas, the JIS further back, the RV further forward, but we were trying to envisage where the boundaries are in terms of what we were looking at. And that is the visualisation I'd be grateful if you could provide us with before you zoom in order that we could discuss it when you do zoom in. And it would probably help. I've forgotten which landscape architect is assisting the council on that, because there are three.
I think it's Mr. Jones.
Mr. Jones.
I think it's Mr. Jones. If you could discuss with Mr. Jones where the best viewpoint would be, because I don't want to get into a position where you provide us with a visualisation and he tells us it was in the wrong place.
Indeed, because it's a very short stretch of road there.
Well, yes, indeed.
Quite credible to have in the right place.
Yes, so as I, could I make that request? So, on Mr. Hunt's time, or we'll move off.
Just to run through that is, and with particular that aspect, with particular regard, there's a road that's used by the bungee.
Yes.
That goes up to the top of that ridge. Mm-hmm. Just in relation to that where it is and located on that ridge, for me would be particularly helpful.
It's the boundaries really. Yes. We don't want you to simulate all the potential buildings and all that sort of thing.
But it's just
where it is. Yeah. Yes.
Where it is in that vista.
Sure, and that was just my point of clarification, was
Yes,
and I'll label those, and likewise on the view from the lookout on the Crown Range.
Yeah. Indeed. Commissioner Dawson.
Just a couple of questions. Am I right in picking up from your summary that the 7 metre building height that you've indicated would be appropriate, you've said that relates to areas 1 and 3.
Yes,
you haven't assessed that in terms of all the areas.
No, that is correct.
Okay. That's not quite the same as what the rules are coming through as.
That is a point of clarification I discussed with Mr. Gibbs, that I am still, in my mind, firm on that 7 metres in 1 and 3 and 6 metres in 2 and 4.
All right, thank you. And the question that I ask everybody is that the purpose of this RV zone, certainly when it was notified, was... A, it was in the ONL, which you clearly are, but secondary, it's in the areas that are remote. Now, you've touched on sense of remoteness in your summary, but I'm interested in, because landscape architects do think about these things and do analyse what remote means, so I suppose I'm interested in, A, what do you think remote means in this district, and whether those attributes apply to the site, or how they might apply to the site or not.
Indeed, and this prompted a lot of discussion in our office actually.
I'm sure.
When we were looking at the project, and I suppose I'll be chatting about skippers later on.
I think we're quite probably hard to argue.
I think there's a general consensus that skippers qualify as
remote.
For those reasons, skippers are remote.
And I might not even ask that question.
That's right. But
this is right next to a resort zone.
That's right. And isn't that far from a highway as well?
Mm.
Easily accessible highway. And when you think about remoteness, it's distant from a place, how easy or hard it is to get to that particular place. Now, in this particular site, relatively easy to get to, relatively adjacent to a number of other things. However, when also one thinks about remoteness, visually remote, and so whilst physically it can be relatively close in this case, I believe it's visually quite remote because it's very well contained, or the landscape, it's a folded landscape up there, you've got a very incised gully, it's very difficult to get clear views into that, and it's like, I was fortunate enough to spend a few days in a pod overlooking Akaroa Harbour just at the tail end of my Christmas holidays, and that was perched up, and I imagine pods like this could actually be perched up in this landscape. Now, relatively close to the Wainui Highway, but I was in that pod and I felt as though I was miles away from everywhere else because of the landscape setting and because of the topography. And so, therefore, in this case, I think of it as the same, and it's that topography and the fact that visually it's actually hard to see and gives it its sense of remoteness. Even though physically, if you look down on a bird's eye view, you might be relatively close to the highway or close to other things, but that's a bird's eye view. On the ground, when you're on that site, you get that feeling of being away from things.
And that could be a bird, if you don't mind, Commissioner. That could be a bird that would be sitting on a pylon wire looking at you. So again, in terms of remoteness, you know, there's a pylon for you. You know, there's a high tensile power wire just right in front of you. So,
mm-hmm.
How does that assist or detract?
Yeah, look, I don't think it does. Does either? You have high tensile power lines running through various different types of various parts of New Zealand in different settings,
through
the middle of Christchurch, through the Lewis Pass. So,
So, I mean, given that remote has, you know, when you look at what it means, it's got these two different aspects to it. It's got the actual distance, is it close or is it nearby to a main centre or a main road? And then there's this, I mean, people talk about the sense of remoteness, but you say visually remote.
Yes. And I suppose visually tying in that sense of remoteness, you're away, you feel as though you're almost hidden from the world a wee bit, so you've got that sense of tranquil, that sense of peacefulness, I think, arise from all of those things.
And because people use their eyes as such an important part of their senses, when people talk about sense of remoteness, would you say that in terms of
remoteness, your visual senses are the most important one. I mean, you could shut your eyes and you can't smell anybody, you might not be able to hear anybody, but they're right there. Visual is really important.
I believe so.
In terms of what gives a sense of remoteness, you can't see other development. What you do see looks as though it's miles away.
Exactly.
Yes.
I agree.
I mean, do landscape architects use a particular set of words for that as opposed to the more physical remoteness? Mm-hmm. What did, in landscape terms, is there a term that you use for that sense of remoteness? Is it visually remote?
I refer to it as visually remote.
Visually remote,
yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. In terms of really the only development area I wanted to two questions. The first is, you've got four discrete separated development areas. Are there cumulative effect issues between having them separated the way you've recommended?
I don't think there are.
The other query I had is about area two.
Yes.
I can understand the analysis that says that however you describe it, the other three are visually discrete, difficult to see, all of those sort of adjectives. Mm-hmm. But area two, again, from our site visit, we stopped on Colpit Road and leaned over the fence.
Yes, under that guardrail there.
And so you see this area of relatively flat land with the gully behind under it. You also see a house right at the head of that area. And so in terms of the planning criteria, whether it's difficult to see, reasonably difficult to see, given that you're an OLL, does this qualify?
That area 2 actually sits in the Gibson character zone overlay of the site, rather than the O&L overlay of the site. And so, potentially, I imagine one could have a residential building to 8 metres there, or a farm building up to 12 metres in height, and only be 6 metres.
Would you like to take it out of the RV zone?
No. So it's not reasonably difficult to see, and it's not difficult to see, and I acknowledge that from Colpit Road. However, it's visually, you can't see it from State Highway 8. Very few, I'm not going to step into traffic numbers, but Colpit Road, from my understanding and my use of it, doesn't seem to be overly highly used. Road, and therefore views of it are for a few and not a lot. And therefore, when I think about things being difficult to see or reasonably difficult to see, it's not from Colport Road. It's only on that turn as you come around that bend and that guardrail, you get that glimpse of it. For the rest of Colport Road, you actually can't see it. But yes, you do get a clear view of that at that point. For those reasons, as an area in the RV zone for potential for development. Topography is nice and flat. It's got a number of other factors that stack up for it as well.
So, dare I say it, taking refuge in a planning response, Mr. Bill.
character zone. If it were not in the Gibson character zone, ignoring the planning treatment, would it qualify as an O&M, in your opinion?
No, I don't think it would. Given, I just need to think about this a little bit. It's in terms of the landform and that transition from it down into the Camp Creek Gorge, it's very highly legible, it's very memorable. In terms of its modification on it and modification adjacent to it, it brings it down in terms of level of assessment. So we're very much on the cusp, Commissioner, between what I consider to be just a rural landscape or a O&L.
Thank you. That was all I had. Commissioner McLeod?
Just wondering, thank you for your evidence, and actually I'd just like to also say thank you for the section that actually tested whether it was an appropriate fit for the RVZ, because that's a question that's come up a couple of times, and it seems that others seem to think, well, that's the one that fits, we'll crack on with that, so it was helpful. In your evidence in chief, you talk about the landscape is currently in a state of change in terms of tourism, recreational activities, modifying that. Are you talking about the Gibson landscape, the specific, or is it the Queenstown district? Or
I suppose you could almost apply it for the whole Queenstown district, but in this case, the Gibson. Gibson Valley, yes.
And in terms of this landscape, notwithstanding your analysis of the RVZ as an impact on it, you've visited, did a desktop assessment. You've been back, I assume, after COVID to have a look at that.
No, I have not. This is my first visit to Queenstown since COVID, since lockdown.
Welcome back.
And thank you very much. It's good to be back. I've been involved in the resort zone as well, so I'm very familiar with the land and the land in the Gibson Valley, and in fact been involved in a number of cases within the Gibson Valley over the last 3 or 4 years. So in the context of all that other work, I'm very familiar. In the context of this particular piece of land, the site visit on the Friday before lockdown, and then following that has been desktop analysis and so forth, so I have not had the chance.
No, I was just wondering as well, because a lot of the way we're looking at this is from the road up at the site from Crown Range across, and this, one of the qualifiers is getting the RVZ is actually getting people into the greater outdoors O&L. What's your opinion? Have you been up the other side and looked back down at the resort from the hill?
No, I have not. I haven't been in this project. I have not walked any of the walking tracks so long. Mount Rosa ridge line or anything like that, and look down. No, I haven't. I have been to the very northern extent of the site and look back. And we did clamber up a wee bit higher and look back down, but that was on private property rather than a public walking track.
That's all from me. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Hill.
Nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Who's next?
Mr. Carr.
John Meadie.
Yeah, Andy, come here.
Given us a summary, Mr. Carr?
I haven't.
All right. How do you want to proceed then?
I thought actually it may be more of assistance if I responded to the points that the council's traffic engineer talk to you about, because there actually isn't a great deal of difference in light of the discussions that you heard this morning with the points that they've raised. So at this stage it may appear that there are some significant issues remaining, but I would contend that in fact I don't think there are at the moment.
Well, if you wanted want to talk to us briefly about what you think are the remaining differences, that's fine.
So I've gone to Mr. Smith's rebuttal evidence where he summarises some of those issues and also highlights some points of agreement. But if I was to firstly look at Mr. Smith's rebuttal evidence, it's his evidence of the 12th of June 2020 and his paragraph 7.17. The first thing that he highlights here is the issue of an intersection improvement scheme, where he says that there's no guarantee that land could be obtained for an improvement if the intersection design required additional land. Mr. Rossiter went further in his verbal comments to you and called it third-party land. It's not. It's owned by the applicant. It's on its own separate title, but it doesn't involve a third party. So if there are, or rather, as there are, intersection improvement schemes that are required, the two parties involved are this submitter and NZTA. There's no third party. Now, the second point is that Mr. Smith had highlighted in his 718 that the applicant submitter has not detailed a mechanism for the trigger of any intersection improvement schemes. You heard from Mr. Gardner-Hopkins this morning that the submitter is comfortable with a limitation of 500 square metres of building, and thereafter the activity becomes restricted discretionary, with traffic effects being a matter of discretion for the council. The same trigger I noticed Commissioner Dawson explored with Mr. Rossiter in verbal comments about what the trigger could be. Well, in my view, that 500 metres limit then does give you that trigger that was being discussed. There's also commentary about the mechanism of who would pay for the improvements. I would contend that the standard resource management principle of developer pays for the effects that they cause applies here as well. I don't think that that is an issue particularly. And finally, there have been comments that NZTA may or may not approve these schemes. NZTA and this submitter have an unusual working relationship in my view. I can't think of anyone that I've ever come across anywhere that has talked to NZTA and engaged with NZTA to the extent that this submitter has. And that's the reason why NZTA is not appearing here, as I understand it, because of this extent of dialogue. Even then, NZTA would still need to be consulted, irrespective of any non-notification process, because in order to undertake any works within the legal highway corridor, you need to have submitted a corridor access request to NZTA, and that shows the improvement scheme that you wish to undertake. And that improvement scheme has to already be seen and checked off by NZTA. So there's no possibility that the submitter could go along and start building things lawfully unless NZTA has given its approval. Now, the final matter relates to commentary about a safe systems approach requiring a roundabout. I'm not sure how familiar you are with a safe systems approach, but essentially it's an approach whereby the safety effects of some piece of transportation infrastructure can be assessed, but it's a scoring mechanism. It would be extremely helpful to you, I'm sure, if I told you that the safe systems approach gives you a score of 44, but literally that's all the safe systems approach does. It's a score.
Sort of like the meaning of life. It is universe and everything.
I wondered about changing it to 42 on that basis for any Douglas Adams people, but the it's simply a numerical calculation that's carried out, and it then requires engineering interpretation as to what that score means. The actual system itself says that scores are not good or bad, and cautions against comparing scores in different locations. So it's not a system that you apply and it says a roundabout is needed. It simply says that the score changes, and then you apply engineering judgment. So it's not as clear cut as perhaps you may have understood previously.
Do you think a roundabout would be required for a building up to 500 square metres?
No.
That doesn't likely, does it?
Yes, it would have a very small traffic generation. I mean, it's one very large house, two large houses. It's a standard 1920s property is 250 square metres sometimes in the middle of a city centre.
Would any upgrading be required at the intersection of Brester Road and the State Highway for up to 500 square metres?
In my view, no. You wouldn't have the sufficient traffic generation to justify it. Actually, I'm just going to rewind that on that one, because I think that there's an intersection improvement scheme where there is minor works carried out, and I think there is a case for that. There's a case for widening the shoulder by a metre or so. Minor
gravel
stuff.
And mud and
But in terms of anything more substantial, no.
But the council, I'll ask Mr. Gibbons, could the council even require the minor upgrading for underneath that 500 square metre threshold?
My understanding of NZTA's statutory duties, the council couldn't require it, but given this working relationship between this submitter and NZTA, it's the sort of thing that would happen anyway. I don't have anything further to say, but obviously happy to answer any questions.
I just had one other question. When we went to the site and you drive up Brester Road and you had a gate, is that the end of the legal road, or does the legal road go right up onto the terrace?
The legal road goes further than that, as I understand it from there.
I mean, the gate's not very far up, there's just a little sort of straight bit off the main road.
It's about here. That's the legal road.
I think you've got Mr. Gibbons onto it.
If I can clarify that, if you've got the structure plan in front of you.
What structure plan is that, Mr. Gibbons?
the dramatic plan on sheet 21.
So this one?
Where do I find that?
Or a version of...
Why don't I just look at Mr. Millen's evidence?
That's the...
Actually, it should be on Mr.
Legal
Gardner's
evidence.
Legals as well.
Gardner Hopkins.
Mr. Gardner's evidence, did you say?
Gardner Hopkins' submission.
Once you go past that gate, which we did, it's quite a narrow road. It's a little track in a way.
That's right.
Where is it part of the site and privately owned, and where is it a legal road?
So when you go up Rister Road, on the right hand side is the old winery building, which you would have seen. There's a bit of a mound on the right hand side with the building behind it. And on the left-hand side as you're going up is the vineyards. Just when you go just past the vineyards, it's still the straight part of the road. And if you've got the structure, the diagrammatic plan in front of you...
Where do I find that?
It's sheet 21 of Mr. Milne's documentation. Should be the very, very last page, I believe it is.
Where
you see the words Arrester Road, the RD,
yes.
that's essentially the termination point of the legal road,
okay.
And then from there it's private access through Gibson Valley Station.
All right, which is sort of where that red line
Correct.
Starts. And where's the gate? We had to open a gate.
So,
sorry, Commissioner McLeod opened the gate and I just sat in the seat.
On that same plan, if you follow the red line up where it gets to the zone boundary, you'll then see where the yellow overlay is, underneath that you'll see a faint white line, which is actually the aerial photograph, and you'll see a fork in the road.
Oh, right there.
See there? And that's where the gate is there, where that U, the bottom of the U is there with the
fork. Yeah, okay. So that's well past, that's well into the private property.
Yes, correct. Yeah.
While we're on that topic, if I may, there's I'm not sure where in the evidence, but there's lots of keeping the roads rural feel. Was that part of your
that
evidence?
Might be in the skipper's evidence.
Is no, it? Here too,
I think it's
in
here as well. But the how can I put this? There's rural and there's rural, and the road up till that point, till that gate is rural, and after that it becomes four-wheel drive, so I'm assuming that that given that most people are going to be FITs and or cycle, that the there's rural and there's rural.
It would need to be upgraded to a standard suitable for its users.
And
and the even if it's a private road, if you're expecting the public to be there, you become the road controlling authority. And at that point, you've got a statutory obligation for the road to be fit for purpose.
And that'll be standard council, NZS, whatever.
It may or may not be. The easiest way of doing it is simply to build the road to the council standard, but most of the time the council standard for rural roads is potentially over the top. So the council standards, for example, don't allow for roads to be unsealed, whereas in a rural area, an unsealed road is not out of character.
No, that makes sense. And one final little addendum. If this client has got such, I'd be happy to take some tips on how to get a good relationship with NZTA. So
you and me both.
Yeah, yeah.
Just following on from that, I noticed in the controlled activity, matters of control in the council's version, even for the initial buildings up to 500 square metres, they had the design and layout of site access, you know, on-site manoeuvring, and so they're sort of anticipating that there might be conditions about on-site access as part of the controlled activity. But I do notice that Mr. Giddens or Mr. Gardner-Hopkins has struck all that out. So,
yeah, I can answer that question. Yeah. It's I've had. I might go as far as saying some debate with various chapters of the plan as we've moved through. I've always taken the view that matters of site access and manoeuvrability are covered under the transport chapter of the plan, and I think there's...
I don't think so, no. Well, we had a lot of discussion about this. Mm. You'd have to convince me of that.
That access and transport and manoeuvring are not covered?
It's totally covered by the transport chapter, yes.
Okay, well, I'm happy to... questions on that.
No, well I'm telling you now, you all need to convince me that the transport chapter's rules mean that no mention of access or design or anything is needed in the zone chapters.
Okay. Well, that's, I don't have
I mean, I know they've got headings, but when you delve into the transport chapters...
Yeah, my understanding of those chapters is there's a trigger point rule for access and access widths, and then there's manoeuvrability standards
with
car parking.
You show me them, yeah. I'm happy to be convinced, but it's not totally obvious. Yeah. For permitted or controlled activities, you know, when you're actually at that easily permitted end of things, maybe it is. So that's why you've taken out all the access stuff, because you think that the transport chapter would cover it all.
Yes, correct. Right.
Mr. Carr, the only one question from me, and that's it. Your paragraph 42, I was looking at the table and trying to understand what this table is telling me.
Yep.
Other than a lot, because I started to think it was like your scoring mechanism. a whole series of numbers, but I don't know what they mean.
Sure.
But did it contain the secret to the meaning of life?
Not yet.
Would it help if I walked you through it?
Please. That's what I would like you to do.
So, for the purposes of this discussion, if you just ignore the larger column saying evening peak hour, we'll just focus on the morning peak hour to work through the explanation. There are typically three aspects of intersection performance that people are interested in, one of which is the delay that a driver experiences when they are at the intersection, one of which is the length of the queue, and the third one is level of service. Now, level of service is directly related to the delay experienced, but level of service means different things to traffic engineers. So, in terms of that particular table, the first row there, rest of road south, being the southern approach to the intersection, there are actually two lanes there, one of which is very, very short, because, like most intersections, the seal width widens as you reach the highway, so two vehicles can queue side by side. So if you were turning left out of Rester Road onto the highway, on average, there will be a delay of 8.1 seconds per vehicle. Because it's an average, some people would have more, some people would have less. And there would be a, not quite a maximum, but a 95th percentile queue length of three vehicles. Now that
was 95th percentile.
It's the 95th percentile, yeah. So it's not quite the worst case queue. And the reason for that is if you look at the graph of queue length, it kind of goes exponentially.
Yes.
So you kind of, when you get to the above 90%, it starts to increase quite dramatically. But that queue doesn't happen very often by definition.
And presumably there must be a baseline in there of, like, you're never going to turn up and just drive through an intersection. You'd have to.
Sometimes you do, even at Rester Road. Sometimes you hit it right, you'll come up to the limit line, look in each direction, there'll be no traffic there, and you'll pull straight out.
But even that's like left and right, that's a couple of seconds right there.
So you have what's called stop line delay, and you have what's called geometric delay. So geometric delay is the delay that you have simply because the intersection's there, so you have to slow down and accelerate again.
Go check.
Stop line delay is the delay that you have by having to stop for other vehicles.
I think the answer, you don't need to go any further. With that initial outro, I'll figure it out what everything else means.
Oh, okay.
And my only other question is that you've suggested that the focus should be on the point at which level of service moves from D to E.
Yeah.
And Mr. Smith disagrees with you and says that's too low.
Yeah.
I invite you to tell me why you're right and he's wrong.
The transition of D to E represents a transition from what's called stable flow to unstable flow. So it's a step change, if you like, where the performance of an intersection or a section of road noticeably degrades. The approach of going from D to E is the same approach that NZTA looked at for the Oxbow jet boating development just towards the east, which is presently being constructed. It's better than was accepted for the Queenstown Country Club at Howards Drive, which is another priority intersection onto a state highway with a 100k speed limit. And it essentially is the point where you have an intersection that is busy but working okay, which slides into being busy and potentially not okay.
Thank you.
I think Mr. Smith has taken a cautious approach by going from C to C to D. But I accept that it's more of a rule of thumb. There is no fixed threshold at which things should change. But if you accept the premise that there is a point at which an assessment is required anyway, where we have more than 500 square metres, my assessment of the point of where you get from D to E is so large that that will never ever happen with 500 square metres. So it becomes not quite irrelevant, but it becomes less important if that trigger point of 500 square metres is there.
Thank you for that. Commissioner Hill?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carr. Mr. Gibbons, I don't know about my colleagues, but I feel like a cup of tea, so we might have a 10-minute